On the program today, in this first hour, we will be wrapping up a series of conversations that we have had with some guests who were involved in a series of lectures that have been going on now for some time at the St. Patrick's Parish Center in Urbana. An 11-part series titled Dialogue into the Millennium, Considering the Past, Reflections on the Present, Hope for the Future. We had several of the speakers in this series here on this program to bring them to a little bit wider audience. It began actually in 1999 and will conclude this week at 7:30 in the evening on Thursday, the 1st of February, with the guest that we have with us by telephone this morning. His name is Robert Wicks. He's professor and chair of the graduate programs in pastoral counseling at Loyola College in Maryland. His academic training is in psychology. He's taught in universities and professional schools of psychology, medicine, social work, theology, and nursing. He is interested in the prevention of secondary stress disorders and also the integration of psychology and spirituality. In his clinical practice, he works counseling counselors. He works with therapists, physicians, nurses, relief workers, people who are full-time ministers. For example, in 1993, he was in Cambodia just prior to the elections there, and during the time, he worked with professionals from the English-speaking international community who were there to help the Khmer people rebuild their nation following many years of terror and torture there. Also in 1994, he was responsible for the psychological debriefing of relief workers evacuated from Rwanda during the civil war there. He has published over 30 books. One that I'll mention just because I happen to be holding it in my hand, Living a Gentle, Passionate Life, published by Paulist Books. And his most recent, or his newest, actually not even, I think, out yet, but due to be out in this spring, titled Snow Falling on Snow, which is published by the same publisher. He's joining us this morning by telephone. So we can talk with him a little bit about his work and give you something of a small preview of the talk that he'll be giving this week. Of course, anyone who is interested is welcome to attend at St. Patrick's Parish Center in Urbana on 708 West Main. Of course, anyone here is welcome to call in and join the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And if you match the numbers with the letters on the phone, you get WILL, which probably doesn't really make it easier to dial the number. But that's the other way to think about it, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, Dr. Wicks, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
I'm glad to do it, David.
This is, I guess, maybe a little bit of a pedestrian kind of question, but I'm interested in your experiences as a counselor of counselors, and I wonder exactly how it is that you got into doing that.
Well, the sense of trust, I think, that comes about when your fellow therapists and people in ministry hear you give a talk or they read one of your books, there's a sense of comradeship. And they feel that they can come in for a consult to talk about what they're going through. And then once that builds up and the word gets around, slowly but surely, as in any kind of practice, you wind up being more of a specialist in an area than you thought you would be when you first graduated.
So these are people that they're consulting you not so much about problems that arise out of their practice, but they are coming to talk about them, their own lives and their own personal problems?
That's right. What happens is, in terms of, people are always curious about what is secondary stress, and it's the stress that people experience when they're intimate with other people's pain. When you're intimate with people as a therapist, as a physician, nurse, or teacher, or relief worker, minister, what happens is you not only catch their flu and their colds, but you catch their stress, their depression, their anxiety. The air is polluted by the negativity, and no matter how well you're trained to keep a distance, be- because you got in the profession in the first place because you care, you often experience those kinds of things.
Hmm. And, of course, a secondary stress can be a factor in anybody's life. You can catch another person's pain that's close to you. You don't have to be a therapist for that to happen.
No, no. And I think that actually what happens is in families, when there's an experience of trust, often it's in those very settings that pain will be expressed by children, by cousins, by brothers. Same thing in business, same thing in the neighborhood. And today, I think, there's a great deal of hurt around. And people will share that hurt, and sometimes at surprising times, and even catch you off guard. I'm trained to do it as a therapist and as a mentor, and even I get caught off guard. I remember a colleague who was going through a great deal of hurt came into my office, and I had been mentoring her. And she said to me, gee, I read your book, Seeds of Sensitivity, and I really liked it. I said, oh, thank you. And then the next breath, she said, too bad you're not like what you've written. So after I prayed for her early happy death, I said to her, well, people write and preach out of their shadows. It's not where they are. They need to point to where they need to go as well. But obviously, I've let you down in some way, so maybe we can talk about that. And we did. But I think the reality was that she felt a sense of safety to be able to share that pain. And I think that that's a message that we all need to know and not take it personally. Parents, I think, take the criticism of their adolescents personally, and it's not meant to be personal. It often happens because they feel safe. And adolescence, as you know, is not a stage in development. It's a serious disease. Adolescents are going through all kinds of hormonal things, and they're wild and woolly, and they share this with parents. And if parents feel a little insecure, they get defensive and they respond in kind, whereas the reality is they feel safe enough to try out criticizing adults, try out disagreeing, and if the parent realizes that, then they don't take it personally and can respond with a sense of calm and a sense of clarity.
I think one of the things that perhaps people don't fully appreciate about therapists is that they are there to help their clients figure things out for themselves. And I think that too often perhaps we end up going thinking that this person has the answers, mm-hmm. where in fact probably we have them. It's just that we need to have some help discovering what they are. I imagine, though, that for the people in the helping professions, it can sometimes be a very difficult burden, the expectations that people come to them with. That is, that I come to you thinking that you're the guy that's going to solve my problems.
Yeah. Yeah, the expectations that people have of anybody in the healing and helping professions are ridiculous. But you have to realize that. I often tell people when I'm working with, I was working with some therapists in Chicago just the day before yesterday, and I said to them, if there is a proverb that typifies expectations for us, it's the Yiddish proverb, sleep faster, we need the pillows. And I think that the whole sense of expectations are ridiculous, and what we need to do is not get caught in that frame of reference. On the other hand, helpers and healers should have good information that can help people. They should be able to sit with them in a way that is respectful. So both the presence of the healer or helper and the techniques can and should provide help, but maybe not at the level that the person comes in with initially.
Well, I certainly wouldn't want to minimize the importance of both training and experience, mm-hmm. for someone to be successful. But I guess I have always thought that perhaps if we were all better listeners and were a little bit better at providing you know, we're sort of better friends to one another, both our friends and our family, that maybe we wouldn't need quite so many therapists.
Well, I think that one of the problems is that I think we are good helpers and friends. I think that today, in fact, we turn to therapists and to professionals too quickly. I did a book for Crossroad Books called Sharing Wisdom. It's on mentoring, and what I wrote that book about is not for professionals. I wrote it for people so that they could sit with their family members, their colleagues, and really extend their natural talents. Let's just take the word respect. I don't think people realize how important that is. I had a client who was sexually abused as a child, and I was seeing her as an adult. And she was right at the end of her treatment, and we were together, and I was watching her bubbling, and I thought, you know what I want to do is I want to interrupt her and have her take credit for how far she's come and reflect on the treatment and what she's done to get to this point so that when she enters darkness again, because darkness comes and goes for us all at different points in life, she'll know what to do. At least that was my brainstorm, because I often tell people in the program that I'm director of, the graduate programs in pastoral counseling at Loyola in Baltimore, is that when one of the students makes an intervention with a client, I should be able to ask, why did you say that? Why did you say that now? Why did you say that now in that way, and what did you expect? At any rate, I interrupted her, and I said, picture my face as a mirror, and what do you see? And she said, oh, I see a woman really alive with herself, a woman who found the child that was lost because of the abuse. She's resurrected her, integrated her with the adult she is now, and boy, she's hot stuff. And I said, yeah, you are hot stuff, but how did you get to this point? You weren't this way when you first came in to see me. And instead of launching into all kinds of techniques that I had taught her, she looked at me and she said, you mean you don't know? And I said, well, no, not really. She says, well, it's very simple. I said, simple? She said, yeah. The first time I came in here to see you, I simply watched how you sat with me, and then I began sitting with myself in the same way. I think if we have that kind of respect and patience and respect with people, they will have it with themselves, and change can take place just by that simple step alone if we don't run away. And I think that's the fear, is that we're overcome by a feeling that we've got to cure people rather than help them cure themselves.
I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Dr. Robert Wicks. He's a professor and chair of the graduate programs in pastoral counseling at Loyola College in Baltimore, Maryland. His academic background is in psychology. He's taught in universities and professional schools of psychology and medicine and social work and theology. Is interested in, among other things, the integration of psychology and spirituality. And as we've talked here, part of his practice is devoted to working with people who, in their work, are counselors, therapists, and educators, relief workers, people who are in the ministry. And he's written a number of books. He will be here in Champaign-Urbana on Thursday for the final speech in the Dialogue into the Millennium series, an 11-part series. It started way back in 1999 and is taking place at St. Patrick's Parish Center in Urbana on Main Street. And this is free and open to anybody who would like to attend. So people in and around Champaign-Urbana are interested. You should certainly feel welcome to go. And if you'd like to call in here, questions, comments, welcome to 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Just continuing as theme for a moment, I'm curious about what you might say about the about how much training in counseling people who go into ministry get, because they are often, they do often have to take on this role. And it seems natural that it comes with the business of being a minister. But I do find myself wondering in the various kinds of training that they get and the programs they go through, how much time is devoted to some training and counseling? And I suppose it varies.
Well, it does vary, but it's very limited. They do usually take several courses in pastoral care and pastoral counseling, and are able to do short-term work. The problem that arises is when they see someone for counseling more than three sessions, and it becomes more intense. The transference, the unrealistic feelings that people have toward them can be very intense, both positive and negative. And unless you're trained to be a pastoral counselor, and that's why they have these masters in pastoral counseling programs now, it can be very, very dangerous. But in the short term, I think they have courses that allow them to project the wonderful wisdom and the caring that they have. And people will often not go first to a psychiatric nurse or a counselor or a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a social worker or a pastoral counselor, but they'll go to a minister first, and she or he can really be of help in the immediate and short-term run, and often are, and that's sometimes, actually most times, enough. However, at times they need to then refer to somebody who's been specially trained in that.
I'd like to have you talk about this idea of the integration of psychology and spirituality. On the one hand, I suppose some people might say that they are akin, because spirituality deals with spirit and psychology can deal with mind, and both of these things they're not the kind of things that you can grab hold of. On the other hand, there are some people who would say that psychology is a science, and well, dealing with spirituality is something entirely different, and those two things are somehow mutually exclusive. How do you see these two things coming together?
Well, I think they come together in terms of their goal. For example, if you look at the Sanskrit word for faith, which is visvas, literally translated, it means to breathe easily, to have trust, to be free from fear. I think the goal of religion, you know, often is to bring people in touch with something greater than themselves so they can be as great as they're called to be by God. Psychology can set the stage for metanoia, conversion, by allowing people to recognize how consciously or unconsciously they're moving toward God or away from God, toward the truth, away from the truth, and be of help. I think we run into problems, though, when we make psychology into a religion. Psychology is a science, just like medicine and other sciences, and, you know, it's just like learning how to plow the field with something that can help you plow it better. I think psychology can help people be wise and get perspective, and you can see a great deal of similarities. For example, people will often come to me because they've blown their perspective out of whack, and I'll help them with perspective. Well, perspective wasn't invented by psychology. It has great biblical roots. In the Talmud we read, you do not see things as they are. You see things as you are. And in the Christian New Testament, Matthew 6:22 says, if your eye is good, your whole body will be good. So you have parallel themes. It's the same thing in terms of ordinariness. Often in psychotherapy, you help a person to get a sense of self-esteem. This doesn't mean that they don't have doubts, but the doubts don't completely throw them off and destroy them. And they become more ordinary so that their energy is not spent on defense. It's simply spent on being themselves. When you have that sense of ordinariness, then people with them are relaxed, so it builds community. Well, on the religious side, you can see the same thing. A number of years ago, Archbishop Desmond Tutu was speaking to the Episcopalian seminarians in New York City at General Theological Seminary. And halfway through his talk, one of the seminarians nudged the dean who was sitting next to him and said, Archbishop Tutu is a holy man. The dean looked back at him and said, well, how do you know he's a holy man? And the young man didn't even blink. He looked back and said, "I know that Desmond Tutu is holy, because when I'm with Desmond Tutu, I feel holy." Now, the question I often ask people in my practice is, how do people feel when they're with you? Do they feel a sense of freedom, a sense of space, a sense of you just simply being yourself and loving yourself? Or do they feel your anger? Do they feel your need to control, to be right, to be seen as perfect or as helpful? What do they see? So I think that there is a real parallel, and I think psychology can set the stage for good religious community and practice, but it's certainly not meant to be greater than religion or spirituality.
I guess, another notion that some people find difficult about religion, and perhaps what I'm thinking about here is about not religion sort of with the big R, but religion with the small R, and in different traditions of practice, is the tendency of people to say, my way or the highway. You know, I've got the truth, and everybody else has got something else, and if you want to get the truth, you can come over and you can practice my way, but otherwise, otherwise what you have is not true, and what I have is true. Mm-hmm. And there again, I that seems to go head on with the notion in psychology that there is, in some sense, finding the truth is an individual matter. That your truth and my truth are maybe different. And again, I guess I'm interested in your reflections on that attitude that some people of faith have that says, yeah, I'm right, you're wrong, unless you're with me.
Well, I think it's, again, the motivation behind it. I think that people do need a balance between certitude and openness. I really think that people are attracted to faiths that do have, some sense of basis, some sense of belief. It's not like standing in the air, solidly with both feet firmly planted in midair. People want something to believe in, and they want something to sort of rest their faith on. So there's that side of it, and I think people have a right to have things that they feel strongly about. On the other hand, what you're picking up is that if the motivation of the believers is insecurity, if the motivation of the believers is something that will give them a total answer and that they won't have to grapple with their faith, then in fact what it turns in is into rigidity. And it's an interesting thing, as you hear some people talk about their faith and you look at their faith, in other words, the religious denomination they're from, you notice a big difference in terms of what the faith seems to be saying and what the person representing the faith or the person going to that church, synagogue, or mosque is believing. So it's the maturity of the believer, the maturity of the minister, that also makes a great deal of difference. For example, you see somebody like Billy Graham. Well, I don't think anybody would accuse him of not having a strong faith, but yet he's somebody who doesn't feel all that insecurity. He was traveling through England at one point, and somebody said that a famous minister in England had said some things about him that were not flattering. And he looked back and said, well, God bless that man. If I were in his position, I'd probably say the same things about myself. I mean, he had just a sense of peace with it. He wasn't concerned about it. I think when you see things that are motivated by hate and fear, though, then no one in their right mind would believe that this is helping us reach God, helping us reach the truth. Instead, I think what it's doing is it's clustering people together in fear and in hate. And I think it was James Baldwin that said people have a hard time letting go of their hate, because when they let go of their hate, they're going to have to face themselves and their own pain. So it is a difficult thing. Religion is certainly a blessing. But with any blessing, it also has its dangerous zones, and they're pretty obvious, aren't they?
Well, we are just a little bit past the midpoint. Our guest is Dr. Robert Wicks. He's professor and chair of the graduate programs in pastoral counseling at Loyola College in Baltimore, Maryland. His training is in psychology. And as I've mentioned, he, among other things, works in his clinical practice as a counselor of counselors. He focuses on working with psychotherapists and doctors and educators and relief workers and people who are full-time in ministry. He'll be in Champaign-Urbana Thursday to give the last talk in the Dialogue into the Millennium series, St. Patrick's Parish Center in Urbana. He's authored a number of books, one that's titled Living a Gentle, Passionate Life. It's published by the Paulus Press. His newest, due out in March, titled Snow Falling on Snow, same publisher. So if you're interested in exploring some of his writing, you can certainly find it in a bookstore, perhaps in the library. And questions also are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. One of the themes that you explore in Living a Gentle, Passionate Life is the importance of having quiet moments in life. And I guess I'm thinking about the fact that I suppose over the years I've talked to people in a number of from a number of spiritual traditions and talked about different kinds of meditation practices and whether it's a something that is sitting quietly, whether it's a kind of meditative exercise, or whether it's in fact something that you one would call prayer. It seems that this is all intended to do kind of the same thing. But I guess I don't know where this question comes from. It's a very difficult question to answer, but I've always been prompted to ask that question, try to get people to tell me, when you do this, what is going on? What is it that you're doing? And of course it's very difficult. If you're having the right kind of experience, it probably is something that you can't put into words or very difficult to put into words. But what is the goal? No matter what it is you call this quiet practice, what is it that you think people are trying to do or are doing?
Well, the goals can be different. I mean, but essentially, whether you call it meditation, contemplation, sitting zazen, prayer. I think when people quiet themselves down, there's a number of goals that people can reasonably have. The first is it sort of lets the dust settle so that you can be a little bit clearer about your life. One senator was once asked in the United States Senate, what's the greatest challenge facing the Congress today? And his response was, not enough time to think. And I think that taking out at least 2 minutes a day in silence, solitude, and wrapped in gratitude allows you to let the dust settle. People will often say, well, you meet 2 minutes, shouldn't you be doing it for 20 minutes? And I say, well, how long are you doing it now? And they'll recognize that because they've set up some artificial goal of 20 minutes that they never do it, they're too busy. But you're not too busy. You can be late 2 minutes. Now, if you want to do it longer, that's fine. I often say it is good to take 20 or 30 minutes in the morning and in the evening, but 2 minutes is the minimum so that you get into a regular rhythm. The first thing I think people recognize is how noisy their life is, so that, first of all, they're a little discouraged because they say, well, I guess this is meant for other people because I'm noisy. I mean, I start thinking about things, and the first reaction I have to them is that this noise is going around your head all the time anyway. At least you've recognized it. The second thing that happens is when the dust settles, they create a vacuum in their consciousness. And what happens then is that, as you know from science, nature abhors vacuums. So the preconscious, those thoughts just below the surface, rise and fill the vacuum. And there we are facing our lies, our doubts, our games, our fears, the fact that we're going to die someday. Now, if we sit there and don't judge those thoughts, don't either repress them or entertain them, but let them move through like a train and observe them, we're going to learn about ourselves. So not only will we quiet ourselves, see what's preoccupying ourselves, but we can also learn about ourselves. And then eventually what happens is the sense of silence. The silence itself, rather than us waiting for some word to come out from the heavens, the silence often is, if you're religious, speaks and is the word of God. So that as you sit in the darkness, in the quiet itself becomes, the darkness itself becomes new light and new information for the next phase of your life. So that people get several things. One is they recognize, they stop themselves from running towards their grave. Number two, they learn about themselves. Number three, they get a chance to breathe and be in the now. And I think that's very important, to be in the now, to have this sense of being there, you know, with a real sense of freshness. And they have an openness so they can learn in a different way. James Joyce wrote of one of his characters, Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. I think prayer and meditation brings us home to ourselves. And then we have a sense of unlearning, a sense of openness to really new learning, because we're not captured while we're running through life. There's a Jewish proverb that goes, do not limit your children to your own learning, for they have been born in another age. I think we recognize that, and we allow not the past just to teach us by remembering, but we let the present and the future teach us by being more open. All of this comes from prayer and meditation. It's so dramatic that Shunryo Suzuki, famous Zen master who was out in San Francisco, when he was asked, how come when people come to meditate with you, they stop taking drugs? What do you do? He says, I don't do anything. I just have them sit zazen, and they quickly forget about those things. I think we don't recognize the power of it. Well, maybe we do, and that's why we don't pray. We're frightened to see the kinds of things that we'll see. But if we have the support of others, if we have a sense of love, and we are open, then the things that we're frightened of will come out in the open. And after a while, they won't be so frightening anymore, and we'll have a greater sense of peace and perspective. That's why prayer is so important.
Well, we have a caller who'd like to join us on the line here, and others are welcome to. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also do have that toll-free line, 800-222-9455. So anyone who's interested in joining the conversation can do that. We have about 15 minutes left. The caller here is in Bloomington, and it's line number 4.
Bloomington, Illinois, David.
Yes, sir. Good morning.
I am in my 87th year, and I have yet to see the need for any religion. Do you have anything for me?
Yes, I think that if you don't feel you've had a need, then obviously you've been a very spiritual person, and a person who...
Spiritual in what way?
Well, because I think that what happens with spiritual individuals, they're able to grasp the wonder of life from many different corners, from friends, from family, from work, from nature, and you're on the right track. And what I would say is continue to draw from those things that you have found to be supportive. And since life's learning never ends, in your reading, in your discussions, even in your call, since you've called and you have that kind of curiosity, continue to look for other ways that you can nourish yourself and continue on the same path.
Well, thanks very much, sir.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, we'll go to the other Bloomington. This is Bloomington, Indiana, line 1. Hello.
Yes, may I ask about this current idea that all religious beliefs are equally valid or equally invalid? You know, there's an assumption. There seems to be this assumption, and you seem to be entertaining it, that all faith is simply based on supposition, and it can't be based on hard evidence. Would you say that faith that is based on research and hard evidence is no better than idle speculation?
Well, it's very difficult because faith itself is based on mystery, on leaping into the darkness.
No, it's not.
I think that I did not say that I felt personally the supposition that all faiths are equal. What I felt is that the people that search for God, that search is equal in the sense that they're all looking to find something deeper than themselves. In some cases, people have found faiths based on certain scientific suppositions, and that has really resonated well with them. Other people have based their faith on a scriptural source, and that has provided a sense of meaning. They have felt that really scripture is a history of discernment and discussion between God and God's people.
In other words, you're saying if something is emotionally satisfying, that makes it valid?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that people see the world in different ways, and you see it in a particular way, and you see, for example, maybe a sense of science as providing a basis for what you believe. Like, what would your religion be?
Well, I'm a Christian, but let me give you an example.
Okay.
Of faith that is based on hard evidence.
Okay.
Simon Greenleaf was a Jewish professor of law at Harvard in the mid-1800s. He was probably the greatest expert on legal evidence that the Western world has ever produced. And he could distinguish valid evidence against invalid evidence.
Right.
And this expert on evidence investigated the evidence for the bodily resurrection of Christ. There was an exhaustive investigation of that evidence,
right,
whether it was valid or whether it was invalid.
Right.
He reached this conclusion.
Right.
He said there is more and better evidence of the resurrection of Christ than that Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar ever lived.
Uh-huh.
Now, would you say that this conclusion by this greatest expert on legal evidence that the Western world has ever produced, that this conclusion is no more valid than a child's belief in the tooth fairy?
Well, you're making extreme things. For example, you're already labeling this greatest evidence, so you've made a decision.
Yes, he was the greatest. Simon Greenleaf is still, his books are still used by our Supreme Court, by our high courts, as in determining whether evidence is valid or not.
Right, but the point of the matter is he's not in the Supreme Court. He's in another area, and you're making a decision that he's the greatest. And that's fine, but you're acting like that's written in some stone somewhere.
Well, I'm saying this. I'm saying I put authority. I'm respecting his authority as one who can evaluate evidence.
Right, and what I'm saying is other people respect other authorities.
Yeah, but
what do you say to them?
Well, if their authority is valid,
yeah,
I say fine. But
how do you determine whether it's valid or not, though?
Just an emotional feeling. If it's just an emotional response, that's not valid.
No. But what I'm saying is, how do you decide that what's more valid? One thing is more valid than the other. Isn't that a judgment, a call on your part?
Yes.
Well,
but the Christian faith. The reason that so many people believe in it is because we call it our historic Christian faith, and it is based on some actual events in history which happened and can be demonstrated to have happened.
Well,
in other words, it's faith based on fact. It's faith based on proven fact.
Well, proven fact according to what you believe.
Well, there are certain rules of logic. There are certain rules of evidence. We use these every day. We use them in courts of law. We use them to evaluate treatises, to evaluate findings, scientific. We use them both in science. Science is based on them. The law is based on them.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's important for you to feel that there are facts there and a logic there, and for you, it does make sense. But for other people, they don't have to be tooth fairy people to disagree with you.
Well, that's true, and they certainly have a right to their opinion, but they can be sincerely wrong, and somebody can think that Drano is cough syrup, and he can sincerely think that Drano is soft cough syrup, and it'll kill him.
Mm-hmm. Well, you obviously know rules of logic, but if you know about arguments, you're setting up an extreme illustration to make your point.
Right. If it were less extreme, would it be less valid?
Well, the point of the matter is, I think that not everybody would fit into that extreme argument. I think that you have a logic for the way you believe, and you're assuming that logic everybody should accept, and they don't.
Yeah, I am assuming that there are some rules of logic. I didn't make them.
No, but you're drawing upon them in a way that assumes that they're valid to such an extent that everybody should believe them, and I don't think that that's really... That's logical.
I think I'm going to have to jump in at this point and say let's move on to another car. I appreciate the caller's comments. Let's go to Southern Illinois here, line number 4. Hello.
How you doing?
Good.
I wanted to call a little earlier, and you weren't getting any calls, and then these other calls kind of urged me to call. You know, I had been weighing heavily on the mind this last week as to the existence of God. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I believe in God, too, and... But we all have a degree of belief that is all to our own, you know. And I got to thinking, well, I was recalled a dream that I had in which, I know it sounds crazy, but anyway, I recall a dream that I had that was so serious to me that one of my children had died, you know, in my dream. And it was real to me. I woke up in sweats. But in the dream, I convinced myself that I was only dreaming, mm-hmm. and this was only a dream. And I kept screaming that out until the point where I woke up. And I was thankful that I had woke up because it was only a dream and my child was still alive. And I got to thinking about that. And people within ordinary life, you know, reality is only real as to what I see as real. But reality to you is different than it is to me. And so I look at that and I say, okay, well, I did not, by when I look at, you know, I go to church and I look at people trying to get a healing and stuff. And I say, you know, I'm screaming out. Most people seem to be screaming out, this is not real. I'm a lie. I'm not dreaming. This cannot be happening, as to the point to deny the power of God. And so then, in that sense, you know, I am my mind is tricking me and believing in my dreams that it's not true. This is not real. And then in my waking hours, my mind still continues to trick me in the same thing. So, you know, and in a sense, to me, I've come to the conclusion that, and this was the conclusion I was looking for, obviously, but I had to weigh it out in my mind, that to deny God, I would have to, in turn, deny myself. I just wanted to say, I don't know what you have to say or anything. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Well, can you comment on that?
Well, I think that it's very hard to comment on that because there's so many pieces to it, but I think one of the things that's important is that we do have a responsibility to educate our own conscience, to look for as much data and information as we can to come to a decision on our own. One of the things, though, is that it's not simply a journey by ourselves. I think we need to also consult people who once were, in terms of their writings, like in the previous call or before the last one, and find, in a sense, people who are around now and writings and people who are around before us to try to educate our conscience and find a belief that we feel, you know, corresponds with what makes sense to us. And then once we do that, we then can take the next step of exploring that faith and seeing if, in fact, it does respond to what we feel is true, what we feel is right. And that's a great deal of responsibility for us, but I think it is our responsibility, but we need not go alone.
Let's get at least one more caller here, someone from a car phone, line number 1. Hello?
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I bet nobody called because we were all listening, fascinated. And so I hope this is one of the programs that you'll repeat. And I just wanted to thank your caller.
Well, all right, very good.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Yes? That was it?
Yes.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call. I appreciate that. Well, then let's try and see if we can get one more. Another Indiana caller here, line number 4. Hello. It's a caller there on line 4.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I just got in on this conversation, but I think you're talking about religion. And I would recommend an article that appeared in the New York Times magazine, January 14th, by Natalie Angier, Confessions of a Lonely Atheist. I think it tells more about religion than anything I've written in a long time.
Good. Thank you.
All right. You know, one thing that I find very interesting is that it seems to me that from listening to the way that you responded to the question that I asked about meditation, it seems that within Christianity there has been relatively recently a great rediscovery of what I would call mysticism. And I'm sure that tradition has always been there in Christianity, but that it's been somewhat downplayed. And I am interested in the fact that it seems to be happening and also in why.
Well, I think you do note that it has been in Christianity for years. Christianity has a richness of prayer in terms of mysticism, silence and solitude, conversations with God, talking to God, reflection during the day, encountering scripture, formal prayer, praying together. I mean, because Christianity is not a religion of the solitude. It's we go to God together, journaling. I think that the emphasis on mysticism now is because we've gotten so into rationalism, so into science, and recently with people looking at science, looking at economics, looking at a lot of the things that have not fulfilled our dreams. We have more and more, and we feel less and less. People began to look to another dimension. And within Christianity, as in with other major religions, there is this other dimension, this dimension of the mysterious, this dimension of the inner. And when we feel this sense of inner peace, then we're able to go and serve each other with a sense of freedom, as opposed with a sense of duty. We're able to feel, in the midst of troubles, a sense that God is with us. And that's very, very important. I think peace is not security. Joy is not pleasure. It's something greater, and that greater thing is found in prayer.
Well, we are going to have to leave it at this point because we've just come to the end of the time.
David, we're just getting warmed up.
I know. I'm sorry. But, well, I guess we'll have to tell people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana if they're interested in hearing more from our guest, Robert Wicks, they should attend the talk. This is the final in the 11-part series, Dialogue into the Millennium. This will take place this week, Thursday, February 1st, St. Patrick's Parish Center, 708 West Main Street in Urbana. And anybody who is around Champaign-Urbana should feel welcome to attend. And, of course, if you can't, our guest, Robert Wicks, has published over 30 books, including some titles, Touching the Holy, Seeds of Sensitivity, After 50, and Living a Gentle, Passionate Life. Dr. Robert Wicks, professor, chair of the graduate programs in pastoral counseling at Loyola College in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Wicks, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome, David.